Session number 17620, James Watts, Reel 4.
Mr. Watts, Reel 4. We were talking about an incident involving Colonel Fillingham, Mr. Watts. What was the end to that?
Well, having reported to the company commander, we went on the demonstration, which went off like clockwork, and the two lads who should have been in there, languishing in the guard room, were instrumental in making it quite a success with the Bringo, because they were very good marksmen. So when we returned to barracks, I was resting on my bunk about 20 past 11 and I heard A Company orderly sergeant blow. And I somehow sensed straight away that something was adrift. I heard hurried feet outside and then a bloke burst into the barrack room and said, Corporal Watts, you wanted at the orderly room, you're on a charge and you've got to be there at the double. So I doubled round to the orderly room and I was ushered in. I was marched in, left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right, turn, 4469415, Corporal Watts, sir. And then the corporal, the colonel went on about, he'd given me a specific order. He says, and you deliberately worked me a flanker. He says, and in the First World War, I could have had you shot. And he said, have you ever been in the guard room? And I said, only on guard duty, sir. So the sergeant major says, keep quiet, that man. And he said, right turn, left, right, left, right, left. And as I was marching out, I said, I would like an interview with the brigadier, please. And I was marched out. And as I was going to the guard room, all the bad lads from the guard room were being escorted to the cookhouse because it was lunchtime. And I was told just to fall in and join them. So I marched into the cookhouse. I said, I don't know whether it was because they knew what had happened, but that was probably the best meal that was laid before me as a corporal or a private. And I was just about to tuck in when the runner came running in and said I was required back in the orderly room. So I went back to the orderly room and there was the colonel, the company commander, the adjutant, and the RSM, and another young officer. And they were all red-faced. There was obviously quite a thing had been going on. And the colonel eyed me with his eye, and he said, I've been given this second thought, he says, I'm going to dismiss this charge. He said, march him out, RSM. And that was the end of that incident.
So you had a right as a soldier, if you felt that your particular misdeed wasn't being dealt with fairly, you had the right to again ask for an interview with an officer higher than the one that was saying you.
Well, I don't know whether I was allowed to, but I was asking for that because apparently there were four things for which you could put man in the guard room, and you can't put one of the men in the guard room because he didn't move when he was being told to. Fall in. One of them might have done that, but you can't put a man in the guard room for having just moved on parade. I mean, that was senseless. Just a few weeks later, my name went up on the notice board, the company notice board, that Corporal Watts was to report to the Advanced Handling and Fieldcraft School in North Wales at Llanberis.
We'll be coming to that, of course, in the story. Can we now start with your movement to School Aycliffe?
Yes.
Was the battalion already formed when you got to School
Aycliffe? Yes, it was well established. B Company, HQ Company and D Company, which was the training company, were in the School Aycliffe. A Company, C Company were out at Scorton, Middleton, St George, guarding the aerodromes. which of course that duty was later taken from them by the RAF regiment.
So, and which company did you join?
D Company, training company.
Can we just look very briefly at the accommodation there, because this was a purpose-built hospital in effect, wasn't it?
Yes, a mental hospital.
Which hadn't really got opened.
Yes, the fact that it was a mental hospital, later on I always thought it was the perfect place to put us, because I think we're all a bit crazy for having joined the army. But no, it was a very good, well-equipped barracks. Probably the best barracks in the country at the time. It was brand new. The huge boilers for making the tea and other things in the cookhouse. We also had a platoon of ATS. I think we were probably one of the first units to have such an arrangement. It was quite good. They did all the duties in the cookhouse. You're asking me about what I slept on at Bransworth and the three bedboards. The one thing that disturbed me more than anything at Aycliffe were the beds, the bunks. There were single bunks with the trellis type of wiring. Sometime, those before us must have been using them for trampolining. And the result was that the trellis had a spar across the middle, but the trellis was sunk over the bar into two separate pots. And the only way to make it a good bed was to fill those pots with any of the gear you had so that you could flatten it out. Otherwise, you had this bar across the middle of your back. But that would disappear when we moved.
And all of the usual facilities, ablutions, toilets and so forth, would be very modern for the time.
Yes, very modern. Good showers and everything. Oh, yes. That was very, very good. It was an ideal spot for to have such an establishment. The lodge house, of course, was the guardhouse. But it was very good barracks.
Was it big enough to house the whole battalion? No. Had the whole battalion come together?
No. It was HQ reserve battalion, a reserve company, and D company, the training company. So more or less three companies. No, it wouldn't have housed the 700 odd men. I doubt whether they could have squeezed them in.
And the food and everything else was basic army.
Yes, the same old thing. Sometimes there wasn't enough. I don't know whether I should recall this when the orderly officer came round and I was at the end of the table and we were having beans and bacon for breakfast. And I got a report from one of the lads on the table that he only had six beans. So when the orderly officer came round with the cook sergeant, any complaints, I said, yes, a private Bailey's only got six beans. And he turned round and spoke to the cook sergeant. And then he turned round again and he said, frivolous complaint, you weren't supposed to have any.
Do you remember the name of the officer?
No, I can't. I'm not quite sure whether it was a Lieutenant Cohen or not, but I always remember that particular incident because the poor lad only got six beans. He was later discharged because he took epileptic fits, that lad.
Did they take much notice of complaints, although they always asked for them when they came round?
Oh, I think so. I don't know whether I might be imagining these things, but we had two, during the life of the battalion, we had two places, farms, where we used to send lads who were a bit wheezy, you know, not big enough, and perhaps I should have gone to one of them. And after a fortnight there, they used to come back full of vitality. I mean, they got extra rations. I think Binks House and Stubbs House, I'm not quite sure what the names were, but there were two places where they went, and they were especially for fattening them up. What was to come, and the food in the main was good. I remember one time when we were stationed in Barnacastle, the colonel who used to sit in the back of his, who sometimes used to drive his officer's scout car, not his scout car, staff car. He would drive, and he put the driver in the back and tell him to give salutes, because we used to salute the vehicle as it went past. He was going up the main street in Barnacastle, and he saw some of our lads outside Fishhoff standing in a queue around about 7 o'clock at night. And he said, "What are they, our lads?" "Yes." He says, "Well, they'll be getting some supper, so they're hungry." "Supper?" He says, "Do they not get supper?" He says, "No, sir." So he said, "Oh, well, in that case, I'd better do something about it." And he went straight back to barracks and called the cook sergeant and said he wants supper laid on for his men. And we got supper. Might have been a pot of cocoa and a slice of bread and butter, but that didn't matter. It was something to eat, you see. Other than that, it was to the naffy for charn wads, rock cakes and tea. But on the whole, I was slowly putting on extra weight and getting big. Of course, I was in the process of growing up from 18 to 20. I mean, they're the years when you've got to do something, you've got to fatten yourself up with something. But the food was quite, I thought the food was good.
Did the area have its own sports fields at that time?
No, we didn't have need of, we did have a sports field as such, but we used it as a parade. We used to do a lot of cross-country running, and we had the boxing, inter-company boxing tournaments. But other than that, we were learning to be soldiers.
And you were all volunteers in the battalion?
Yes, yes. There might have been one or two waifs or strays, but there'd be just one or two. There was a lot of old soldiers, you know, pre-war soldiers. Some men were in their 30s and 40s, 50s. They were very good.
Were these the instructors or just men who were in the battalion?
Well, you'd have a chap in the cookhouse. I remember one in particular, he was 44-year-old, and he was a good boxer. He'd been the Indian champion in the 1930s, and he could still stick out a straight left and flatten anybody, you know. I thought they were good, the old lads.
And these were basically amongst the staff, though, the older men?
Well, they would be the cadre, you know, the thing which forms a battalion. You get a certain group of men, you put them together, and they're the ones who... They've got some experience of what the army's all about. It must have been an interesting thing for them to do that. I know they were proud. They cried when we marched away.
Who was commanding the battalion when you joined it?
Colonel Hubert MacBain.
And we have touched upon him.
Yes.
Did you like him as a commanding
officer? Yes, he's a very gentleman. Gentleman, nice type. And then, of course, we were taken over by Peter Jeffries, who was just young.
So MacBain was there when you arrived. Who was 2IC?
Major Taylor.
Again, was he a well-liked officer?
Yes, another elderly. You see, we were young lads and they were elderly men, and at that time you had at least respect for your elders, whether they're officers or not, doesn't matter, with the way we were brought up. They don't seem to have that nowadays, do they?
What makes up a headquarters and headquarter company?
Well, at that time, you would have some specialist troops, machine guns and things like that, the heavier weapons. But later on, they formed S Company, a specialist company. So you had A, B, C, D, and the S Company, and the headquarter company, which is the administrative company, of course.
And you said there were four companies in the battalion.
Yes.
What makes up a company?
Three platoons. Each platoon has three sections in it. About 20 or 30 men. You might, later on I found out that if you had about 19 and 20 in a platoon, you were lucky. Fast as we were putting them in, they were going off.
And you say you're in D Company. What was your role in D Company? Were you in a rifle section?
Oh, yes. All the four ABCD, they are all rifle companies. And we, of course, were in the process of learning how to march, route march, do your kits, keep yourself clean, learn discipline, learn the effect of the weapons and how to look after your weapons. It's a university. It's a military university.
Do you recall the number of the section you were in D Company?
No, but I was with 17 platoon. You see, you've got three platoons in each, or three or four platoons in each company, and 17 coming at the end of the line.
What is the balance of the platoon? You'd have rifles, so many, well, Ben guns, so many.
Well, that's right. Each section would have an NCO who would probably have a, if he was a corporal, he'd have a submachine gun, a Tommy gun, and the rest would have rifles, apart from two in each section who would be number one and number two on the Ben gun, so one of them would have a rifle. And in the little group that formed the platoon headquarters would have the two-inch mortar.
And who commanded, what rank commanded the platoon?
A lieutenant. Second lieutenant or a lieutenant or a sergeant. It all depends. If officers weren't available, the sergeant would take over.
In commanding sections, what was the rank there?
Corporals and lance corporals. Normally a corporal.
So you get pretty close to your own little group of men.
Oh, yes. Very, very, very close indeed. I mean, this is one of the features that and which I found very strange. I used to sit and wonder, what am I doing here? And I was sitting beside a man, I didn't know his name. I knew his nickname, but I didn't know anything about him. This is later on, of course, when I was in battle. And just as I was getting to know him, something would happen to him and I'd get somebody else.
Do you recall any of the men in that very first platoon that you joined?
Oh, yes, I can think of most of them. Corporal McIntyre, ex-boxer. Corporal Hutton. Corporal Latimer. Now, Latimer, Hutton, and a lad called Watson, and another one called Buchanan, they all disappeared after about 18 weeks, I think it was. They went to Okju, and I never found out what happened to them. They were nice lads.
And their background must have been pretty good to be chosen for.
Well, yes, there were ex-grammar school lads, Darlington and Richmond grammar schools. I believe Latimer went out to India, commissioned in the Indian Army. But I don't know whether he survived the war or not. We had a very mixed bag, but most of the lads were working class. If they'd had a job, that is.
Amongst the men, do you recall some of your comrades?
Yes.
Again, in this first days.
Bousfield, Willetts, Russell, Monaghan, Beatty, Thompson. He was a good boxer. I think he pinched my boots.
What was their background? Where did they come from?
Children all round County Durham, Sunderland, Darlington, you know, all County Durham lads. You see, they were patriotic towards the county regiment. And that's why I find it difficult to understand why getting men to be so dedicated and to instill them the esprit de corps, that's vital, and then to send them away about 2 years later, to scatter them to the far corners. I don't see the reason behind that. It might be that the hierarchy were thinking of the lads from the PALS regiments of the First World War, when a whole village could be wiped out. You see, that didn't really happen to the 70th Battalion, because we were scattered around all the various counties and that. Although we did get a batch of Middlesex lads to join us later on.
In the beginning, though, it must have been very much like a PALS battalion, because you were Durham lads and you did off and you had all volunteered.
That's right. Yes, that's true. With, of course, the same type of things that interested us, you know, the one or two would pop down to the pub and have a pint now and again, but a lot of us didn't drink. I didn't drink and I didn't smoke.
Yeah. What was the age range of the battalion by and large?
Oh, I would say the average age was below 19. We were very, very young.
And at that time in the war, were you unable to go abroad because of your age? You weren't.
I believe we weren't allowed to go abroad before we were 19, and then they raised it up to 20.
And that must have been the moment when the battalion went out, because in effect.
That's right. You see, the thing was, they decided that, I think what it was, the young soldiers battalion, there were quite a lot of them in the country at the time, they'd been set up for doing things like aerodrome defence, which they did a good job. It was decided, of course, that the RAF regiment would take over that duty, so that they were decided to disband the young soldiers battalions, and because of that, our battalion in particular was kept on to become the demonstration battalion for the Northern Command School of Infantry.
Yes, we'll come to that, of course.
And some of the Middlesex lads whose battalion had been disbanded, and they were chaps just the same as ourselves, young lads, 18 to 19, who had volunteered for the diehards, they came and joined us. They might have been reluctant faithfuls, but they were still nice lads. We soon piled up with them and got to know them.
Yes, so I've come across there was a great rivalry, evidently a fighting rivalry, between the Middlesex and the Durhams, if they ever met.
Well, not in our battalion, there wasn't. You would fight back to back.
I've heard, of course, that when Durhams and Middlesex were close together, there was this.
Yeah, well, whoever put them together did a good job. That probably should have what happened in Northern Ireland now. That would be a good idea, wouldn't it, if they all marched together.
So, there was young age, and as you say, after the others were broken up, you became a demonstration battalion. But the reputation of the battalion became quite high, didn't it?
For
discipline and smartness and ability.
Yes. But you know, I was taught how to present arms to the Queen. Not present arms in the normal fashion, you know, from the shoulder to the slope to the present. We had a particular thing where you went down and you genuflected on one knee and presented your rifle to the Queen, the butt end. You know, it was a particular. I can't remember the intricacies of the move, but we were taught to do that. And we were also taught to march at the normal rate, to the regimental march, the light bark. And we were also taught to double march to the regimental march, the key row. So what it was the pre-war soldiers teaching the things that they had learned. And not many battalions, I suppose, got things like that handed down to them. So to me, it was a privilege, and I lapped it up. I like, because I love marching, and I love them being the instructor, teaching them how to march.
In the early days, as you say, you'd only been in the army 3 weeks, I think you said.
Yes, when we went to the Young Soldiers Battalion.
You had a great deal of basic drill still to learn and perfect.
Well, normally 12 to 16 weeks. I think it was 16 weeks when I joined, but I think I was cut down to 12. By which time we could march 5, 10, 20, 25, 30 miles with full kit. You know, by the time we finished our training.
And other drills presumably were involved, bayonet drills and firing weapons of one kind or another.
I've still got me instruction book.
Were new weapons coming in at this stage of the war to the infantry?
No, didn't alter much. As I said earlier, that had been issued with the Ross rifle, but later on we were issued with the Lee Enfield Mark IV. Some of the lads had the old Lee Enfield from the First World War, and I think they preferred that to the Ross rifle, the Mark IV, which had a little meat skewer bayonet, whereas the Lee Enfield Mark I had a 17-inch bayonet. And I think for ceremonial purposes, you could handle that better and look more effective. You know, you had to slap it. I loved drill. I loved it. I still admire the lads in the marching up and down on Horse Guards Parade and things like that. But I still think the Durhams are the smartest, or the light infantry.
Who was your platoon commander, your first platoon commander?
Lieutenant Anand, VC.
This is Dickie Anand.
That's right.
Who got his VC in France in 1940.
Right. Yes.
Now, he'd been afflicted by that particular event, hadn't he?
Yes, he was a little deaf. Still is, of course.
How did you get on with him?
Oh, he's an excellent man. He's what you call a tough. He was exceptional. I was a bit surprised when he said that there was a possibility that I'd be made a sergeant within a year, and I laughed at him. But it was true. I didn't think so. I remember saying to an elderly officer not so long ago, about 3 or 5 years ago, I said, "Why did you make me a sergeant?" And he said, "Well, you're one of the many," he said, "that we just had to shout," and he said, "and it was done straight away, or else."
So Anand was well respected by the men?
Oh, loved. He
and
was well loved.
Presumably his fellow officers as
oh,
well.
Oh, he's well loved, was Dick, because he was a human being.
Was he personally aware that he was a VC holder? Did he put over this
I don't think he had any. I don't think he had any presumptions of any kind like that at all. What he'd done, and that was what he was teaching us how to do, you know. No exceptional thing about Dickie Anand. A plain, honest, good officer who taught me how to cross a river with these collapsible boats. It was a terrible day, the day that we were to be taught. So we all went down to the gym, and we got these collapsible forms, which are about 6 feet long. They were the sides of the boat, so you had two forms, and they were the sides of the boats. And he taught us exactly how we would approach the river, launch the boats, and what to do when we got the other side. And 2 years later, when I did that for real, it went like clockwork. So it works.
You mentioned the route marches, and did you gradually build up to those route
yes.
distance? You didn't
yes.
didn't do too long on one. What would you carry on a route march?
Well, a rifle or a machine gun. Your pack with the necessities to subsist in the countryside. We didn't carry a lot of gear, you know, but we did when we went into action, of course. But
did you sing the traditional army songs on your route?
Oh,
march?
Yes, Colonel Bogey and what have you.
What happened if anyone fell out? Were they picked up by some means? Or?
Well, I can't remember. I can't remember anyone falling out. That was something which I had to do, by the way, later on, examine the feet. See if they had blisters and tend to their needs.
This followed every march, did it?
More or less, yes, more or less, to see how we... Because I used to put rub my feet with methylated spirits. I never had any bother at all. I could walk with holes in my socks and I never got blisters. But I was lucky.
Did you have a regular stop on the
march? Oh, yes, 10 minutes fallout.
And what was the drill then when you fell out?
Well, we would march along the road, and whoever was leading the squad would say, "Right, 10 minutes halt, fall out." So we halt and just collapse in the side with your feet up.
It was that was a special reason for putting your feet up. Wasn't
oh
it?
Yes, that's right. And then he said, "Right, get prepared to move, move."
What was the idea about propping your feet up?
Well, it relieves your feet.
Wasn't to put the blood running the other way.
Well, I should imagine. That's probably the thing.
But you were, in effect, taught to sit down and
think. Oh, yes, and do that, yes. Later on, I could fall out and I could nod off for 10 minutes. And someone would come and wake me up, and I said, "It's all right, I'm just resting my eyes."